I'm delighted to have with me an actor and adventurer who knows all about scaling those amazing heights. He is, of course, Brian Blessed. Hello, Brian.
That's a big build-up. Is that Suzanne?
It's me.
A wonderful build-up.
Oh, I know. Well, you deserve a big build-up. I mean, you hardly need any introduction. Your hearty voice is enough for most people to recognise at once.
It's marvellous talking to you. Welcome. It's what a marvellous programme. What a marvellous idea.
Oh, brilliant. Well, I must just say, just mention about your voice very briefly before we mention about your adventurous side. Few would expect you to be shy and sombre, but I guess that was what was called for when you were, in fact, an undertaker before you trained as an actor.
Yes, I was. Yes, I had to leave school at the age of 14. I was born in Mexborough and then lived in Goldthorpe, a halfway between Doncaster and Barnsley, a coal mining village. My dad was a coal hero. He only just passed away, just over 100 years old,
wow.
This Yorkshire coal miner. And they were great, exciting days. It's just... What was your question, sorry?
Well, if we would expect you to be quiet because you've been
an
undertaker.
I had to leave school at 14 because he was crushed in the coal mines. He's a coal hero. It got better. It took 2 years. And I had to leave at 14 and do my schooling at night whenever I could. I had lots of help, lots of marvellous teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was an undertaker's assistant. You couldn't get work for about 35 shillings a week. And I used to make the coffins eventually and put the bodies in and so forth. And then I moved on to plastering and became a plaster's apprentice, big firm, and became a master plasterer.
A master plasterer,
had to be
fantastic.
A plasterer from age of 14 to 18 and doing my schooling at night. During that time, of course, there were lots of kind of... The amateur theatre in South Yorkshire was in... very powerful. People like Keith Barron and Judy Dench were in amateur theatre, and Patrick Stewart, who became my great companion, who was younger than me, he was in the next village in Dewsbury.
Wow.
And we went on drama courses together, weekend drama courses, and then once a year in the Calder High School in the Calder Valley, and which was got all the world's best teachers there. And we had so much help, Patrick and I, but I remember that when eventually we went to apply for a scholarship, it was unheard of, at the Bristol Old Theatre School. We arrived there, and Patrick, we had no GCs, we were both secondary school boys, and I could only fill in the date, and he was the same, and sign it. And then all the grammar school boys, they filled in their GCs and everything else. And then the Wakefield board looked at us all and said, well, they're giving the two scholarships to Brian Blessed and Patrick Stewart.
Oh, and the rest is history. Amazing.
And they said, because we've seen your acting. Mm. And it's acting that counts. So, you know, and that was it. So we owe them, the Education Authority in Yorkshire, you know, a debt of gratitude.
Oh, I think the other way round as well, isn't it?
Tremendous amount of help. And,
fantastic.
And we went to this great school. I did my national service first. And then Patrick didn't have a national service. He just missed it. And I went and I was in the parachute regiment. And then after that, straight into drama school. Then into rep, Nottingham and Birmingham. Then in a wonderful documentary. So I was going to go straight to Stratford-on-Avon, but I did a semi-documentary drama series called Z-Card.
Yes, I remember. I know, I was going to say, yes.
We became me playing the character Francis Smith, the policeman.
Yes.
And, you know, we were as famous as the Beatles. I mean, for 2.5 years in black and white. I mean, we were on the front page of a newspaper, Z-Car Storm, you know, controversial Z-Cars. And I was the tough guy, Francis Smith.
Yes, I was going to say, what was it that took you fancy about that part? Terrible pun, but it had to be said.
Fancied himself physically as a kind of tough guy.
Mm.
But Judy Dench played my girlfriend in that.
Ah, really?
Mm.
Oh, well, there you are, isn't it? I mean, the thing is, you all come together again, isn't
right.
it? Which is fantastic. Of course, Bristol Old Vic is a lot of talent there, including yourself and Patrick Stewart as well. But I was saying about your grave-digging role. I mean, obviously, you know, playing the Undertaker would have been perfect in Hamlet, but of course you were the ghost of Hamlet's father, weren't you, which you
yes,
portrayed
yes,
Kenneth Branagh.
It's interesting. I keep reading the different Hamlets. There have been four this year. And all the critics, throughout the years, they spend three-quarters of the report on Hamlet. And then you don't hear them talk much about Gertrude, or maybe Ophelia, a little bit about Laertes. And Claudius is a gigantic part. I mean, it's almost the size of Hamlet. I mean, it's about two-thirds of Hamlet. And he always gets about three or four lines. Oh, he was bluff, or he was this, or he was crafty, or a miserable son of a bitch, etc. And he never gets a write-up. I think it's because I think Claudius, not like Richard III, who you adore, Claudius is a character that, as soon as he walks on the stage, the audience loathe him on sight, you know.
Yes, yes.
I think the critics pick it up as well. They don't want to, I don't want to talk about him because he's such an appalling human being.
I know, but within every appalling human being, you always manage to find the sensitivity in the character as well, which is amazing.
And of course, he does talk. His philosophy is pure and wonderful and inspired. His idea on politics and philosophy and conscience is so terrific.
He
is the ultimate liar.
Yes. How did you find Kenneth Branagh's interpretation in comparison to other Shakespeares that you've done?
Well, of course, I did play Claudius at Stratford-on-Avon, and didn't enjoy playing him because I find him such a repulsive person. The director at the time thought he was a marvellous, that underneath it all he could have been a good king. I said, never. Never, he could never be a good king. I said he premeditated murder. He kills his brother, the king. When he kills his brother, it means he kills himself. He kills his wife. He kills Hamlet. He kills Polonius. He kills Ophelia. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. I mean, you go on and on and on. Of course, the repercussions are terrible.
Yes.
So there's nothing about him that's redeeming at all.
No, it's hard to find anything there, isn't it?
A frightful murderer.
Oh, absolutely.
The ghost, I always feel... Of course, in the film with Ken Branagh, Ken said... It was very sweet and flattering. He said, I'm not going to do the film unless you play my father, unless you play the ghost. And, of course, in his film, he does a full version, you see me not only as a ghost, but you actually see me as his father before I die as a ghost. You get these lovely, sweet scenes, which he filmed marvelously. And he said, no, I want you, you're not Claudius in my production, Brian. You are the king, and the king must be a warrior king. He must be powerful, almost 8 feet tall. He's a man who's settled all differences with other countries in solo battle. He would take on the opposing king and defeat them. And he was a Hamlet adored his father because he was such a great warrior. He was like an old Achilles. He was just Hector, an heroic, wonderful figure. And he said, I want you to play it. So I had this wonderful makeup and these wonderful eyes for the ghost, which were terrifying, a man about 10 feet tall.
Well, it's a great presence, isn't it?
It's
yes.
Sweet of Ken to do it and say, well, I won't do it unless you're the king.
Absolutely.
And so that was lovely. Wonderful director. I mean, Branagh, I met him at Stratford. We got on marvellously. And then we'd done Henry V there, and me, Exeter, the Iron Duke, the power behind the throne, you might say. Mm-hmm. And I always feel that Ken Branagh's film, Henry V, is the best film he's ever made. I've just finished his last film, As You Like It.
Mm-hmm.
And I play, he said, well, I want you to play in that, the gentle, philosophical, the loveliest man in Shakespeare, Duke Senior.
Mm-hmm.
And white hair, white beard. Has usurped Rosalind's father.
Yes.
Usurped his kingdom and castle is usurped by his evil brother, Frederick. And he said, I want you to play both parts. So in the film, and he said, both parts are very quiet. And Frederick's in black armor, Kagamusha, and set in Japan. And I have scenes with myself, which is very fascinating.
Yes.
And Branagh's direction was simply sensational. But Henry V, you know, was just wonderful. I think that... As You Like It's a lovely film, and Hamlet's terrific. But I always feel Henry V, Marlon Brando, it was his favourite film. And I just feel all the British actors in it are sensational performances. I mean, all the small parts are dotted. You know, Judi Dench pops in just for a little bit.
As she does. Is she going to win an Oscar?
All the actors in it are on the battle scenes, and it's so organic and real. And I'm covered in armour all the time. He was known as the Iron Duke Exeter, and entered the French court covered in armour.
Wonderful. It's like one of our listeners, actually, Chris, he's just asked, do you feel, you know, do you go for the heart and soul of the role? Is that where you go from?
Obviously, I think so, yes, you've got, yes, indeed, yes. I think, to a certain extent, once you've studied your Shakespeare, then you've got to have a healthy disrespect for Shakespeare. I mean, you've got to obey all the laws of speech and et cetera, because that rhythm has a power. and which is so wonderful. Mm. In Shakespeare, invented our language. I mean, 15,700 words vocabulary. Our vocabulary is about 200 words, isn't it?
It's outstanding what he did, isn't it?
So the vocabulary and his phenomenal grasp of human nature and the things he says. I mean, you take a little bit from Macbeth the other day. So I'm going to do a whole program on Shakespeare with Stephen Fry. And he said, what's one of your favorite lines, Stephen Fry? I said, well, light thickens. What? Light thickens? I mean, the way Shakespeare, where did it all come from? You know, this blessed isle, etc. Of course, as you know, for the comic side of it is, in the World Cup, England didn't do well.
We don't talk about that, do we?
Yes, in the summer. And of course, yes. Gary Lineker on the BBC, once he'd finished speaking with Alan Hansen and Shearer, said, now we cut to Brian Blessed. And I, of course, I abbreviated once more into the breach difference. Well, it ended up with, God for Fabio, England and St. George! And
yeah. Oh, but it was worth it for that.
For about 3 weeks, I'd actually recorded a quarter-final speech, a semi-final speech, and the final speech, in case we got to the final. We never got beyond the first round.
Oh, Brian. Oh, it was all there, wasn't it? In the can, ready to go.
But it's amazing how you can apply Shakespeare, which...
Absolutely.
I think if you get Shakespeare right, there is nothing more powerful or natural. What I'm going to say is that Shakespeare was for the people.
Mm.
It's for acting,
yes,
more than reading. You know what I mean? Get out and act it.
And definitely. So, make it live.
Yes, that's right. What I say is therefore it can become too precious. It can become, oh, it's Shakespeare. No. It's for the public. It's for the people.
Yes.
That's where I think Branagh does so well with it.
Yes, he does. It's the interpretation. And just as if he was speaking it, you know, because it is people having conversations with each other, just happens to be in a different time, I guess.
That's right.
That's the thing. Now, of course, talking of words and being a great wordsmith, you are a great wordsmith yourself, because many of our listeners have read your books, The Turquoise Mountain, Brian Blessed on Everest, Nothing is Impossible, To the Top of the World, and The Quest for the Lost World. And now, you often portray strong and quite amazing characters on stage and screen, but in life you're very much drawn to inspirational characters, aren't you, who
have
achieved
strange
great
in
things.
My life that 50% of me is an explorer, 50% actor. One seems to kind of complement the other.
Mm.
But I would say that my biggest love in life is exploration.
Mm-hmm.
I only say that because I look back to my childhood. And what did I love? We had a wonderful childhood in the war years. We had Flying Scotsman, all the wonderful steam trains on the railway nearby, and the Mallard, the great Mallard, with its Bugatti front. So, and on the radio, we had The Lost World. The radio, we didn't have television, so these wonderful Saturday night theatre, The Lost World, The War, The Worlds, and the acting was sensational. Their radio acting, we can't compete with it today, because their radio acting, those to win Oscars for their radio acting. And so it was so exciting to hear all this. We had two local cinemas, of course. We had Flash Gordon every Saturday in black and white.
Of which you appeared in.
Crab as Flash Gordon.
You did.
And I would always, when we came out of the cinema, I'd always pretend to be, as a little boy, Voltan, the Flying Hawkman.
And you were.
I never dreamt that one day I'd actually play Voltan.
Amazing. And you said that immortal line, didn't you, Brian? What was it now?
Gordon's alive!
Love it. Fantastic.
I mean, everyone asks me, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. Everywhere I go, people ask me to say Gordon's alive. Can you put it on my telephone? Can you do this? Can you just shout that up to the scaffolding in London when I'm doing a voiceover? And there all the workers are above me. Brian, shout Gordon's alive. And tax him and say Gordon's alive, Brian, into my telephone.
And say, it's a legendary, isn't it?
Old movie.
Oh, wonderful.
I tried to get Buster Crabb in it. He was the original Flash Gordon, a marvellous Flash Gordon. I tried to get him just one scene where the aeroplane at the beginning of the film is about to set off, and the mechanic in the background, you know, you see him. By the way, where that mechanic in the background putting the petrol in, that's Robbie Coltrane.
Yeah. There's always one that pops up, isn't there? And you go,
I always thought it'd be nice if his father could have taken him to the aircraft and it'd be Buster Crabb.
Yes.
I met him, he was 87, and he looked 40, with silver hair.
Oh.
He ran gymnasiums in America. He died recently,
mm-hmm,
at 100 years old. A massive physique,
yes,
and a wonderful-looking man.
Yes.
And he passionately wanted to be in the film. And Laurentiis, Dino Laurentiis, mean sod. He wouldn't let him in. I couldn't understand why. I said, oh, have Buster Crabbe in it, please.
It's amazing, isn't it? Some of these people, have they keep themselves so fit and so well. I mean, talking of which, you do as well, because you... really, you know, you've been given so many, you've been given awards for your mountaineering.
I'd always loved adventure. It was my big love. I'd listening to The Lost World, then I discovered on the radio that Arthur Conan Doyle's Lost World really exists. It's in Venezuela. Roraima, The Lost World. Mm. Everard Infirm first went there, and he reported on this. There are all these Tapuis, flat-top mountains, 9,000 feet high, with Roraima, the Lost World. And he went there and made the first ascent, British ascent. Mm-hmm. He came back to London, gave a lecture, and Arthur Conan Doyle attended that lecture, and it inspired him to write The Lost World with Professor Challenger. And so I loved actually going there and finding the same route and doing it. And then, the kind of love of the mountains suddenly, over the years, they asked me, different mountaineers, Brian, please tell the story of Mallory and Irving who disappeared on Everest in 1924. There is no doubt at all that the greatest expedition ever mounted on God's earth was the British expedition to Everest in 1924. For courage and tenacity, wearing Norfolk jackets and puttees and pith helmets. And Mallory was the great Mallory. He made Cambridge stand still.
Absolutely.
When he appeared, and people christened him Sir Galahad. And everyone said, some people were looking at the Matterhorn one day and said, oh, the Matterhorn looks so wonderful, but we can't take our eyes off a man in blazer and flannels. Discovered his name is George Lee Mallory. And Mallory had this effect, and he was a great, great climber like Reinhold Messner. Mm. And everyone said, you must do this. You must tell the story of the 1924 expedition, because of Mallory and Irving were last seen 600 feet from the top at Everest. 30 years before it was climbed by the British coronation year, Hillary and Tenzing. This was 30 years prior to this. They were last seen near the summit and the mist came down and they were never seen again. A great mystery. And he was called Sir Galahad. Sir Galahad disappeared when he touched the Holy Grail.
Sir Galahad the Brave, was it?
And Mallory disappeared when he was touching his Holy Grail near the summit. And we didn't go there to find bodies, but to pay tribute to these great climbers and their great ideals. About 200 of them went in 1924, the British. Marvellous expedition. But, I mean, they couldn't mount it.
No.
I went everywhere. Paul Getty I met. The BBC would pay half the money. It was too expensive for a documentary and too cheap for a drama. I went everywhere. People promised money, but they wouldn't. You've got to hold on. I'd say to your listeners, hold on to your dreams. And remember also that there is no one like you. Nature doesn't cheat. We've all got something that no one else has. And then suddenly, we got the money. Huh. And we were off. And of course, but I was 53. I mean, you know that Messner retired. The greatest climber the world's ever known is Reinhold Messner.
Mm, absolutely.
And he, first man to climb all 14, 8,000 meter climbs. The great, and first man to climb Everest without oxygen. First man to climb Everest solo without oxygen. And he retired from high altitude climbing at 47.
Yes.
And I was now suddenly, it had taken so many years to get the money for this thing. I was 53. And I'd never been to the great heights. I'd been up Kilimanjaro and things like that.
Yes.
I'd never been to these great heights. And anyway, I we made the one of Galahad of Everest, which won John Paul Davidson. I think 12 Grand Prix throughout the world. It's his film.
Yes.
And I wore the same clothes.
You did, didn't you?
And I went to just at the point where we managed to get to the point where Mallory disappeared.
Mm.
And we made this, won all these awards for him. And
fantastic.
That was exactly. I remember the day, that I was on the North Ridge at 53 years of age with the camera boys, David Bashir's a great American cameraman and great altitude climber. 2,000, 3,000 feet below me on the North Col. And they said I'd never be able to do that. And there I was in my Norfolk jacket.
Yes.
And I was at 27,000 feet above them, all on my own on the North Ridge of Everest, my blood pounding. And, of course, I've discovered, of course, which is wonderful, that I have this gift for altitude. And it was uncharted country because no one at that age had gone up there without oxygen. I've never used it. Mm-hmm. Subsequently, I've been to 28,500 feet, and I was almost on the point of reaching the summit without oxygen when I was 66.
Incredible.
And I had to help a Catalan climber who was dying to get down. Another three-quarters of an hour, I'd been, half an hour, I'd been on the summit. But I had to help him. I had to get him down.
I mean, we've had questions about the altitude, how you dealt with it, but it sounds like you're a breed apart.
My lungs are twice the normal size.
Well.
And my blood has a strange peculiarity in it. Or as my wife says, yes, I'm in your bloody head. But I feel... And, you know, rather, you know, people say, isn't it dangerous going to Mount Everest? Isn't it dangerous when I went to the North Pole? I said, well, the greatest danger in life is not taking the adventure. That's the biggest danger. Go for it. I mean, Everest can be a greenhouse, a garden, or, you know, or somebody taking an extra step in their Zimmer frame in a hospital.
Yes.
That's an Everest. And I feel Everest is a very symbol. But, I mean, of course, when I first saw it, after all those years, because I read about Mallory when I was 7 years of age in the Hotspur comic.
Really? And you've been climbing for years, haven't you? Mont Blanc, you did when you were 17.
Dreams in the age of seven.
Yes.
Suddenly, northern side to see Everest like Mallory did, and gigantic in the sunset with David Bashir's alongside me, and Vistas and all the great climbers. And we sank to our knees and wept because it was lovely, blood red and golden in the sunlight.
Oh, amazing.
I went there. It was so wonderful. The Sherpas touched me. I was wearing the scarf of the Dalai Lama because he blessed the 1920s expeditions. And Dalai Lama reenacted the ceremony. I wore his scarf. And the mountain was so kind to me. When I did start to ascend it, then the weather became like the Mediterranean. And the Sherpas said, we've never known it like this. There's no wind, no nothing. Amazing.
You were actually blessed.
Taking my tweed jacket off.
Getting a bit warm there.
That's right, I'm getting a bit warm.
Brian, I would love to have you come back on the show and talk in more depth about this, because it's absolutely fascinating.
Yes, I'm going to. I love doing the North Pole and Aconcagua and mountains like that. And when I was, for your listeners, when I was 17 years of age, I'd not climbed a big mountain at all, and it snowed, and I wanted to climb Mont Blanc. And I was completely excited. And I made my way with £7.10. I wanted to climb with Bonatti, the greatest climber in the world at the time, the great Bonatti in Italy. And I managed to get all the way down to Italy, hitchhiked, and got down there, and was Chamonix, thousands and thousands of climbers, and, you know, people like Bonatti could charge $10,000 to take a man up Mont Blanc. And he'd just come down some of his great, like the Drew, and they said, you haven't got a chance to meet Bonatti, he won't even see you. But he did. In his restaurant, thousands of people all gathered around laughing. And I said, I've come all this way from England, I've hitchhiked down. I've always wanted to climb Mont Blanc, and I haven't climbed a big mountain. I always want to climb it with you.
Oh.
And he looked at me and he said, give me your, how much money you got? I said, well, I've got £5. He said, give me £3.
Oh, wonderful.
No, you're an apparatus, your jacket's hopeless.
Oh.
I've got some boots, and I've got some clothes.
See, this is what happens with spirit, isn't it?
I ascended Mont Blanc with Bonatti.
That is absolutely amazing.
I'm just saying, write your own scripts in life. Go and do. If you want to work with Spielberg, write to him and say, I've seen all your films. Can I just have a tiny part? You know, I adore your work. Write to them.
Absolutely.
Go directly to them and cut out the bureaucrats.
Oh, I love it. I love your attitude, Brian. I could talk to you all day. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Congratulations on the programme.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been an absolute joy and an honour to have you, Brian Bliss. I know there's lots of questions for you, and I'd like to get you back on again. But maybe you could say a big shout out, literally, to all our listeners today.
Well, I want to say, first of all, Gordon's alive! Oh, well, who wants to live forever? Squadron 40, dive! That's on my sat-nav.
Oh, the sat-nav, we love
it. The voice of Tom-Tom.
The voice of Tom-Tom. If you want to get that in your sat-nav, you'll never get lost again. The fantastic Brian Blessed. Thank you so much for joining me today. That was a wonderful guest of Brian Blessed.
Brooklyn's Radio. Loving arts and entertainment.